This is Up to Date on KCUR 89.3. I'm Steve Kraske. Few journalists in this country can say they've had the impact that Nicole Hannah-Jones has had in the past few years. For starters, she developed and led the 1619 project that the New York Times published in 2019. In it, writers including Hannah-Jones focused on slavery and the contributions of African Americans as central to this country's founding narrative. Her essay for that project won the Pulitzer Prize. But she was also in the middle of another firestorm that centered on her efforts to win a tenured chair from her alma mater at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. She was ultimately turned down, apparently because conservatives connected to the campus objected to the findings of the 1619 Project. Today, she's a tenured faculty member at Howard University in Washington and holds the Knight Chair in Race and Journalism. She'll be visiting Kansas City on Friday, and she joins us now. Nicole, what a pleasure to have you. Welcome to the show.
Good morning. Thank you for having me on.
You know, maybe the first question is, has life managed to calm down for you just a little bit these days?
not really, but in all good ways. So, you know, the 1619 Project has completely taken over my life, and we are in production on the 1619 documentary, which will be a 6-part series to run on Hulu. So it hasn't really calmed down, but I'm very grateful.
Well, let's go to that 1619 Project that had so many Americans talking. Where did the idea for that project come from?
You know, in some ways, I've been working towards the 1619 Project my entire career. I've been a journalist for 20 years, and I've spent much of my career really using history to help us explain racial inequality in society today. Mm-hmm. So as the 400th anniversary of 1619, which was in August of 2019, was approaching, I was kind of obsessing over the fact that most Americans still did not know the date 1619, which we mark as the beginning of American slavery. But more importantly than that, most Americans did not have an understanding of how foundational slavery was to the country that would develop and how the legacy of slavery still shapes so much of American institutions and society. So I wanted to pitch a project to commemorate the 400th anniversary that would have the scope that I thought that moment required.
You know, one main narrative of that project was on the central role to this nation's founding that slavery played, along with the contributions of African Americans, as I mentioned. In fact, the series contends that the nation's point of origin took place in August 1619, when the first enslaved Africans arrived in the English colonies. Why did that idea prove to be as controversial as it was?
So just to slightly alter that framing, what we argue is that what would it mean if we thought about 1619 as our origin and not 1776? Hmm. And that if we contemplated that so much of our society's most vexing issues do not begin with these ideals of liberty in 1776, but with the practice of slavery in 1619, that we may better understand our society. Now, why is that proven so controversial? Well, because we understand how important the mythology of 1776 is to American identity, to American nationalism, and to those in power who want to maintain kind of the current hierarchies of our society. So in some ways, right, I went this project goes directly to the most sacred aspect of American identity, which is, yes, you know, this country has done some bad things in the past, but we were founded by these intrepid colonists, these men who had these unheard of ideals of universal liberty, and that is kind of the defining identity of America. And this project is pushing back against that and actually saying, you know, the men who wrote our founding documents, who put forth these ideals that all men are created equally, engaged in slavery, in chattel slavery, and they denied liberty to the very people who forced labor gave them the wealth and power to go up against the nation or the world's most powerful empire. And we haven't wanted to grapple with those truths. You know, we acknowledge slavery. Of course, we cannot help but do that in this country. But what we don't want to talk about is the role that slavery plays in the founding of our nation and the revolutionary period, and how central slavery is to our to the social, economic, political, and legal systems that would develop in the United States.
So you were shaking the very pillars that sort of undergird what this country was founded on, and so at least the way people perceive it.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, the two most contested essays in the project are the two essays that go most directly towards American mythology and identity, which is capitalism and democracy. And to be clear, there are 1,000 endnotes in the 1619 Project book. Most of the book is written by academic historians, and the project really relies on more than six decades of scholarship that is fairly settled in the field. So it's really not that radical. But what is radical, I think, is that this project has managed to be a popular history, right? A public history, that it has permeated that membrane between the academy and popular understanding. And that is seen as dangerous, particularly in a time of demographic change in the United States, of intense political polarization. And so we have become caught up in all of those things.
I'm visiting with Nicole Hannah-Jones, who spearheaded the 1619 Project for the New York Times. Was there any part of this project where you were you intentionally being provocative, Nicole?
Of course. I mean, to me, the entire project is provocative. It intentionally so, right? If we were telling kind of a settled and comforting narrative, there would be no reason for this project to exist. If our country was willing to acknowledge the foundational role that slavery played in shaping our society, but also the way that the legacy of slavery still shapes our society today, this project would not need to exist. So yes, the project is trying to reorient our focus to, you know, we've had a very narrow lens through which to view America and American history and America today. And we're trying to broaden that lens to say, you know, there's a lot that is happening in the silences that is shaping a country that is exceptional, actually, in many ways we shouldn't be proud of. And if we can confront that truth about our country, it is going to be difficult, it's going to be challenging, it's going to be uncomfortable, but it allows us then to build the country of our highest ideals. So absolutely this was, you know, I was not naive to think that you would make the arguments that were made in the project and everyone would embrace these arguments, or that you could say, what if we thought of our founding as not freedom, but slavery? Yes. You know, that was the point, was to make people uncomfortable so that they could have a better understanding of their nation.
So as you look back on it now, and as its impact continues to reverberate, how much impact did it have?
You know, it's hard to assess, you know, your work while you're still in the midst of it. But what is clear is this project has provoked a profound reaction. As you know, the project has been criticized and condemned from the most powerful men in this country, the President of the United States, the Secretary of State, Senators Mitch McConnell and Tom Cotton. It is being legislated against in many states. It really is the genesis of the anti-CRT propaganda campaign and all of those laws, including in your own state of Missouri.
Critical race theory you're talking about, right?
Exactly. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So the impact has been, I think, you know, much larger than anything that I could have imagined. My main goal was I wanted people to know the date 1619. I wanted them to grapple with what it means that slavery is one of the oldest institutions in what would become the United States. That has been accomplished. And what's clear is you do not have this type of power aligning against a project that is not being embraced by many, many Americans, that is not having an impact. So I think, you know, the long-term impact is yet to be determined, but this project has exceeded every expectation I could have had for it.
You know, you mentioned the critics, and some conservatives said you were painting America as fundamentally racist nation. Is that what you were doing?
You know, when critics say that, they think that what they're saying is something that's controversial. I don't think that it is. We are a nation founded on the belief that indigenous people were savages who didn't know how to use the land, and so that land could be taken from them, and on the belief that people of African descent by nature were enslavable people, were a slave race. This is written into our founding documents. We were a slave society based on racialized chattel slavery. Yes, I think we were founded as a fundamentally racist country. And I don't actually understand how that can be controversial when we simply read the words, documents, and laws upon which this country was founded. But what I am saying is that there have always been, what the project argues, people who did believe in those lofty ideals of our founding and who fought to turn our country into a multiracial democracy, a place that had equal protection before the law. But I don't understand the controversy about arguing that we were created as a racist country when clearly one only has to look at the words of the people who founded us to know that that's true.
Nicole Hannah Jones is my guest. Again, she spearheaded the 1619 Project for the New York Times. You also received some blowback from a group of historians who wound up disputing this idea that slavery was essential to the launch of the American Revolution because colonists wanted to protect their rights to own slaves. What did you make of that criticism?
Well, I think there were several things going on. One, to be clear, I expected critique of the project. You don't produce in a project that's this ambitious, that makes these arguments and not expect critique. And critique is normative to the field of historiography. Historians regularly write papers critiquing the works of other historians, but that's not what was happening with that letter from those five. They weren't simply saying we disagree with the arguments. They were saying this project is wrong, it's discredited, it shouldn't be taught in schools. But what we need to understand is that the field of historiography is made of human beings, and that there are plenty of historians who also feel that they need to further this idea of American exceptionalism, who want to downplay racism as core to American identity. And that was the response I think that we saw here was a group of historians who really want to put forth a narrative of America as being founded by these intrepid demigods who, yes, they were flawed, but they fundamentally believed in equality. Well, that's just not, I think, historically accurate. And if you look at, you know, those five historians got a lot of attention, but there were lots of historians who were pushing back against them, who wrote articles, who published papers that disputed their framing and their critique, and they got almost no attention whatsoever. So if people go to the book, they will see that we responded to that critique, that the arguments about the role of slavery in the revolution, about Abraham Lincoln, about abolitionism, have many, many citations from very renowned scholars whose views align with ours and whose work is where we got this these arguments from.
You know, Nicole, you mentioned the reaction in states like Kansas and Missouri, where conservatives criticized the project because some say, you know, they said it's revisionist, Nicole, and used to turn students against their own country. What do you say to that criticism?
Well, one, it is revisionist, but calling history revisionist is really a redundancy because that is what historians do. If we knew everything there was to know about history, if there were no new interpretations to be had, why would we even have historians? This is what historians do, right? They continue to find new documents and they continue to make new interpretations of events that have occurred in the past. So it absolutely is revisionist. And we say that explicitly. We are trying to reframe the understanding of American history. We are placing slavery at the center of the American narrative. But that, again, is based on decades of revisionist history that has been done by academic scholars. I'll give you a quick example. I know it's radio, so my answer shouldn't be super long. But, you know, when Annette Gordon-Reed, the Harvard scholar, put forth her book on Sally Hemings, arguing that there is proof, right, making the argument that Thomas Jefferson started a relationship, a sexual relationship with Sally Hemings when she was 15 years old, and that he fathered several children by her. Scholars said this was revisionist. Many scholars panned the work. They tried to discredit the work. And now we all know, yes, it was revisionist because white male scholars had no interest in showing that there was a sexual relationship between Thomas Jefferson and Sally Hemings, or acknowledging that he had these children. But being revisionist doesn't mean false, right? It just means that we are looking and understanding and interpreting history in new ways, and hopefully you know, in different ways and seeing things that had been glossed over when the profession was largely white and male. So yes, that is what we are. But again, revisionist is not false. Revisionist is saying, you have looked, you have told this history in this way. We are adding in new understandings about what happened in the past.
You know, there were even efforts here in Missouri from some lawmakers to ban race-related teachings in public schools altogether. Did you see that kind of response in other states as well?
Oh, absolutely. So we know that some two-thirds of states in the United States are trying to either pass or have passed legislation limiting how you can discuss race in the classroom.
Two-thirds of the states, you're saying?
Yes, they are either they either have laws that they're considering or they have already passed those laws. And then, of course, that doesn't even count the local school districts that are curtailing how you can discuss race and the history of race in the United States. Things that in some ways are ludicrous, except they are frightening at the same time. So there was a school district in Georgia where a school was named after a formerly enslaved man who became an author and a prominent citizen, and they outlawed the teaching of his autobiography as racially divisive, and the school is named after him. We know in Tennessee, a school district banned the teaching of Ruby Bridges, the first Black child to integrate a school in the South. They banned the teaching of her picture book, her autobiographical picture book, as racially divisive, and it is just a historical text. So we should be very, very frightened about these laws. One can disagree with the 1619 Project. One can disagree with any text. But you do not ban books in a healthy society. You do not ban ideas simply because you don't like them. And I think this wave of laws that are really trying to restrict free speech and children's right to learn should be very frightening for all of us, no matter where we stand on the 1619 Project.
And I was going to say that turned out to be the legacy of the 1619 Project, this banning of race-related teachings. How would that hit you?
Well, you know, on the one hand, I have to admit, I feel tremendously honored that powerful people would be so frightened of a single text that they would feel the need to try to legislate against it. And what we know is it's not working, right? So people don't like to be told what they can read. Children certainly don't like adults telling them that something is so frightening that they are going to restrict it. And so people are, they're not complying with these bans. They are finding creative ways to get around these bans. There's a young lady in Texas who started a banned books book club in her city where they are, the students are reading all of the books that the district has tried to ban and discussing them. The Brooklyn Public Library is offering free access to students across the country in states that are banning texts to these texts online. So I've been really proud and encouraged at how people are fighting back against these bans. And I don't think the legacy of the project will be book bans. That's on the regressive politicians who are planning the bans. Right. The legacy of the project will be that people can be so afraid of knowledge that they have to react in these ways. And I think people are going to, you know, this book has been very successful. You wouldn't be banning something if people were not reading it.
I just have a little time left here, Nicole, but I wanted to ask you about your switch from journalism to academia. You were recruited heavily and persistently by the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, your alma mater, to come to that school to teach down there. And then ultimately, the chancellor of the university, the dean, the faculty all signed off on a tenured position for you there. But then ultimately, the Board of Trustees stopped you from getting that position, again, because of the maybe some a conservative member of that board who had objections to the 1619 Project. What was that like for you to have your own alma mater reject you on that basis after all the effort you put in to get that position?
It was extremely painful and embarrassing.
Crushing, I assume.
Yeah, it really was. And to have it play out so publicly was quite devastating. As you mentioned, I I still work at the New York Times. I wasn't even looking for a job in academia at that time, but I had been recruited. I love my alma mater. It's been very good to me. Prior to the 10-year debacle, I had received the Young Alumnus Award, the Distinguished Alumnus Award. I had been, a few months before that, inducted into the Hall of Fame there, the Journalism Hall of Fame. So to have gone through that experience because really they didn't like what they believed to be my political views was really challenging. And ultimately, because of all the protests around it, they did vote to approve my tenure, but I no longer wanted to come and work at my alma mater, and that's why I decided to go to Howard. But I think the important message there is two things. You know, I was not rejected for that job because of my qualifications. I have, you know, the most qualifications of anybody in the journalism school, if you look at awards, right, if you look at tenure, if you look at impact, and every other person in that position had come in with tenure, and I went through the tenure process.
Right.
But more critically is I was determined to show that even in situations where people believe they have power over your life, that you always have power. And I was going to exercise that power. And that's why I ultimately chose to go to Howard University, where I'm founding the Center for Journalism and Democracy, which we will actually officially launch in November.
Well, what a great conversation. Nicole Hannah-Jones, again, the driver behind the New York Times 1619 Project. Nicole, what a pleasure to have you on the show. Thanks so much for your time.
Thank you. I really appreciate
it. You bet.
Up to Date is a production of KCUR 89.3. Our theme music was composed by the great Bobby Watson. The program is produced by Danny Alexander, Zach Wilson, Elizabeth Ruiz, and Reginald David. Our engineer is Paul Nakatura. I'm Steve Kraske. Thanks for listening.